I was a surgeon. I was not sure what I was going to speak about, but the surgeon was going to talk. And so I just started meditating. And felt what was appropriate. And part of the reason I'm choosing this particular topic this evening is because of some questions I was asked beforehand, and also because of some of the things which happened at a monastery idea this week. And so this topic is going to be one of the fundamental parts of early Buddhism. I call it early Buddhism because this is what I call the Buddhism of the Buddha. The Buddha was around at the early time of Buddhism, and this is what he thought, this is what he understood and explained. And it was a teaching which, for some time, was in my monastic life, certainly for some time in the life when I was a lay Buddhist, I thought was not all that important. It was maybe an interesting part of Buddhism, but not an essential part. As I practiced and experienced insights and studied to confirm those insights more and more, I understand that this is actually a very fundamental, important part of the whole path of Buddhism, which leads to enlightenment. And this particular topic is reincarnation, or rebirth. Sometimes we think this is just something by the side. But it turns out, and I'll explain this hopefully in my talk, it is a very essential and important part of Buddhism. So when we start talking about reincarnation or rebirth, the difference between these two has been made by some scholars, but it's not really worthwhile distinguishing between these two. People have a reaction sometimes. Many people have told me here that there's much about Buddhism that they can accept, but reincarnation or rebirth is something which they find hard to accept. Especially because people come into Buddhism with the understanding, and it's an accurate understanding, that Buddhism is not dogmatic, it's not telling you what you have to believe, but pointing the way, acting as a mirror to one's own inner experience. A mirror being something by which one can see the reality inside one's own self, inside one's own being, inside one's own experience. The pointing out is something which you can find out by yourself. So you don't really need to be told, and you don't really need to believe what you're told, which is an important aspect of Buddhism. And so this encourages people to go on this a journey of self-inquiry, of inner inquiry. Where they are given guidelines, where they are given means by which to carry out this inquiry, and there are maybe some of the things they should look out for are described, but they're not forced or compelled to believe in anything. And because of this, people think of the idea of reincarnation as something which you don't have to believe. But if the mirror is held carefully and clearly in front of one, one should be able to see its truth. But again, as I mentioned a moment ago, that many people have come to me and said they find it hard to accept this teaching. To me, when I first heard this, I thought, actually, how strange. What is it inside a human being that makes the idea of reincarnation just so unacceptable? One of the things I found that people have different standards of proof. We want to prove these things for ourselves. We want to find out these things for ourselves. But the standard of proof we demand before we accept something quite often depends on how easily it fits in with the ideas we bring in to Buddhism, with the ideas we bring in to this room when we listen to this talk. So often, we do not listen to what's being said, but what we want to hear. We don't look at life as it really is, but how we want it to be. And if you talk about reincarnation or rebirth, if it doesn't quite fit in to what we want to believe, we'll demand a standard proof which can never satisfy us. The standard proof is what we call our ultimate proof, to prove beyond all possible doubt that such a thing exists as reincarnation or rebirth. That's a standard of proof if you apply to other things in our life, shows that we can't prove anything at all. When I was given a similar talk about this, I've given a talk on reincarnation for many years here, but I brought in Melbourne earlier this year, and saying that, we all believe that the sun will rise tomorrow. If I ask the ultimate proof of that, you cannot give it. You don't know. Just because the sun has risen every morning for the last million, billion years, and even that you're only taking on other people's opinion. For some of us, we haven't seen the sun rise in many years, we got up so late. But we accept that the sun will rise. Prove it. Now, of course, the standard of proof required for something as mundane as the sun rising is not really that demanding. And we can accept in a way that we feel for ourselves, we don't have to believe anyone else, that the sun will rise in the morning. And if you apply a similar standard of proof to the facts about reincarnation, it's very easy to accept. Now, sometimes I say the standard of proof we should apply is the same standard of proof demanded in common law, in the law courts of the Western lands. If the 12 people can agree, in these important words, beyond reasonable doubt, then they can act on that decision. We're not asking for ultimate proof, but beyond reasonable doubt. So that we can have a working hypothesis, we can have a working idea of what we should be doing, because the truth or otherwise of reincarnation is fundamental to many of the things we should be doing or not doing in our life. It's fundamental to our worldview, fundamental to morality, fundamental to meditation and insight even, and certainly fundamental to achievement of full enlightenment. Just to point out here, the Buddha once said that the person who does not believe in reincarnation, who does not believe in karma and its results, he's called a wrong view. And while a person of wrong view, it's impossible for them to gain any of the stages of enlightenment. I actually said that. When I read that, I thought that this is really saying straight out that this is a fundamental part of the Buddhist teachings. So, as a Buddhist, or the other Buddhist teachers, is to hold up a mirror, point out some interesting areas to look at, and in so doing, we are using that type of proof which is called, by Western lands, a scientific method. Now, I was brought up as a scientist before I became a monk in theoretical physics. And the sort of standard of proof which I used and saw other people use and accepting in theoretical physics, which most people believe in those results these days, except some few fundamentalist people of other religions. But if one looks at the standards of proof required in modern science and applies them to something like reincarnation, what have we got? What's the evidence? Well, the evidence we have is that there are certain people alive today who can recall their past lives. What actually are they recalling? They are recalling experiences or memories which they claim to be memories of a past existence. To them, there is no doubt. To them, the memory of a past existence has the same quality as the memory of this existence. And this is an important point. You think to yourself, what were you doing yesterday? Where were you at this time? What is it? Just past 7:30 yesterday, on Thursday evening. Now that memory which you recall, you know it was you doing that. There's a sense of identity in memory, the sense that this was me, the sense you are not tapping into some other person's experience. You're not tapping into some store of all human experience. That this was you. And it's the same quality as anyone who has a past life memory, an experience of some previous existence. There's something in that memory which says, this was actually me. And it's also, these memories have many facts which can be checked. Again, one of the reasons why I'm giving this talk this evening is because we have a few monks who've just recently come to our monastery. At our monastery, we have a little videotape of a program made by Channel 7 some years ago of the reincarnation experiments made in Sydney, where a psychologist was using hypnosis to get past life regressions. And of all of his patients, he chose four people who turned out to be women, who had memories of a past existence which were open to investigation. In other words, they were very recent and in lands where records should be kept. They should have done well checking these. And it was so that they could, because these were ladies in Australia, they could very easily dismiss the possibility that they could have access to this information because they had never been to any of these lands where the past life occurred. One of these, many of you may have remembered this program, we showed it here a few times on occasions. One of these ladies, for example, was never been out of New South Wales in her life. Such a thing could be checked very easily by going to the passport office and seeing all the records. And she recalled an existence in England in about 200 years ago. And there's no way that she could access to all of those memories of places and names and identities living in New South Wales. They just don't have those records, not even in the library. And so it was easy to check that they could not get access to this information any other way. And they took these ladies overseas, following these cameras, it was good TV. And I'm sure that the participants got a nice holiday in Europe, and the psychologist got a bit of extra income from the TV, and the TV got a lot of money from the adverts in between. And all this was very convincing if one had an open mind. There was one lady who remembered an existence as a man, as a doctor in a previous life. And she remembered the name of the doctor. The name she remembered was James Archibald Burns, in a Scottish town called Blegarry. She'd never been even to Europe before. And one of those coincidences, one of the chances that she could actually take, say, the date in the 1870s, the doctor in a town which, you know, I was born in England, I've visited Scotland many times, I never knew the existence of such a town, a very small town, not Glasgow or Edinburgh, any of these famous towns, but a small town. There are chances that there is actually a town called Blegarry in Scotland, and that in 1870 the doctor was named James Archibald Burns. But a doctor was a well-known person in the vicinity, and people used to keep records in England, in Scotland. And so they went there and looked at the records, and everything they found, in many records of meetings and other things which the doctor, the only doctor in town, his name was James Archibald Burns, M.D. Pretty very convincing evidence. Now, of course, that when we have evidence like that, we have to sort of really look at it very carefully and see if there's any other explanation, any other way that a person gained that information. In books? No. The only place they found this information was in the bottom of a small library, a small town library. How can one get that information in any other way? Sometimes we say that we're just, again, I mentioned this earlier, that we're delving into some storehouse of human consciousness. Tapping into it somehow. But these people have the emotional reaction to these memories that they were actually there. It was me. It was I. Just the same as I could not convince you that the memory of what you were doing yesterday was tapping into someone else's memory. So that we have some solid information then. Now the point is that if one person, if I can convince you, or you could understand that one person had lived before, then it's quite logical, quite reasonable, scientific, to say, well, all people must have lived before. All of us must have had past lives. And in fact, to prove the truth of reincarnation, all you need to do is to prove that one person had been reborn. the proof is there. So what are the objections against this? And sometimes we have the common objection that, it's a very common objection, that how can everyone be reborn? How can everyone have a life before? And it's quite well known that there's so many people in this world today. And the population has increased so much over the last 20 or 30 years. It's not just enough human beings living beforehand to supply all the human beings who are here now. There's a common argument which really doesn't accept that the human being is not the only life form even visible on this planet. In Buddhism, as if you've been coming to these talks, I gave a talk not so long ago about the various lines of existence in Buddhist cosmology. Human beings is only one amongst many realms of existence. Those realms of existence include the animal realm, and also realms which are invisible to normal people. The ghost realms, and you may know someone who's actually seen and experienced the ghost, and there's no way you can convince them out of this. You may have actually seen it yourself. The ghost realm is a realm of existence which the Buddha described very carefully and very precisely. As well as these realms, there's also the deva realms, these realms of heavenly beings. And in this round of rebirth or reincarnation, beings go from one realm to another realm, not just from human realm to human realm to human realm, from many, many realms. And when we include the vast resource of all the beings in all of the realms, it's very easy to understand just how many human beings today can count their past life not in the human realm previously, but one of the other realms, whether it was an animal realm, or a deva realm, or a ghost realm, or whatever. Sometimes people object to the fact that they've been an animal in the past life. But look at the animal realm. You know that there are some animals in this realm whose characteristics are so human, and in many humans whose characteristics are quite animal. Now I had to laugh at that because somebody once told me, said, what's wrong with animals? And indeed, there are some animals which have such obvious human characteristics that becomes very striking. To many people that they see this in their dogs and their cats. I remember there was one monkey in this monastery in Thailand who was given to the monastery and was a very young monkey. It wasn't a chimpanzee, it was some other primate, I forget exactly which. And this monkey was just so accustomed to the monks and the novices around there, that when it came to the afternoon cup of tea, they used to sit around with the monks and novices, with its cup, holding the cup like all the other monks and sipping. And it was very clear it actually thought it was a human being, or very close. And many of its characteristics were almost indistinguishable from human characteristics. For those of you who have read some of the books in here and seen that in Jacko's new book, True Freedom, there's a story there which I told here many times of the cow which cried. And that was incarnate truth and form. A cow was going to be slaughtered in the abattoir there. And it was the man who was going to be slaughtering it was this huge Irishman. I won't tell the full story because many of you have heard it before. And when this cow came in to be slaughtered, rather than showing signs of fear and terror, which was the experience of most cows being slaughtered, it came in slowly, purposefully, one foot in front of the other, very carefully, and it got between the stainless steel rails which were there to hold it still enough so that the assassin could actually hold the gun to its head and just stun it. Apparently, I'm not sure if this is the normal way to kill animals for beef or for pork, but he said that because the animals were in such terror, you could never actually put the gun to the right place. They'd be moving so much, shaking or trying to escape, so the first shot was just the stun to get them still enough so they could aim properly the second time and shoot to kill. First the stun, the second to kill. This animal came between those two stainless steel rails, stopped, looked up at this big Irishman, the prisoner who was doing the slaughtering this day, and looked him straight in the eye. And as the assassin was also looking, he could at least, the slaughter of this prisoner could not take his eyes away from his cow. He'd never seen anything like this in his life before. And as this eye contact was maintained for I don't know how many minutes, he noticed water swelling up above one of the cow's eyelids. Cows have big eyes. It took a while before the water to get to such a quantity that it started trickling over the eyelids and running down the cheek of the cow. A few minutes later, water welled up in the second eye and trickled over. The cow was crying. At that, the prisoner just threw down his gun, swore in the coarsest prison Irish slang to the meaning that he was not going to kill this cow, nor any other cows or pigs or chickens or anything else in his life. He's been really moved. He's seen the humanness. That's not quality humanness, it's his own quality in himself that he saw in that cow. The fear of death, the longing to live, the search for peace and comfort. This is just one example of as many of the closeness between the animal realm and the human realm. And it was not an uncommon thing for beings to be reincarnated backwards and forwards among these realms. And so this is just an indication. It was how that argumental objection about the truth of rebirth or reincarnation can be argued. That we come from many different lives, from many different realms of existence into this realm, and from this realm we go out to many different existences, not necessarily human. Who knows where? I'll mention this afterwards. Other people argue that it's all very well, but how do I really know? How can I really prove it to myself? And we know there is a way of proving this to yourself once and for all. Just in the scientific method, we demand there must be some experiment we can perform to prove it for ourselves. That experiment was described by the Buddha. The way to recall one's past lives, however, first requires a great deal of commitment and training. Just the same way, in order to prove the existence of, what, say, the Big Bang, or the fact that there are universes in this cosmos, requires a lot of training. You have to go to university, get a degree in physics or astronomy or whatever, and learn how to interpret all these data and use computers and whatsoever. People understand that not everyone can access this information for themselves. In the same way, not everyone can do this experiment which the Buddha described to find out for yourself the truth of your past existence. Because the crucial training here is in the power of your meditation. The depth in which you can calm your mind down, gain clarity, and as the Buddha said, to make the mind malleable, to make the mind workable. Just like a potter takes a piece of clay, which is not too wet and not too dry, and can turn it into any shape which the potter likes. In the same way, through the power of meditation, the mind becomes just like that piece of clay, not too wet, not too dry, so you can turn it into whichever path you wish. In particular, once the mind is malleable in this way, once it has clarity and power, you can do the reflection on past lives, which is a very simple thing to do. It's hard when you haven't got a workable mind. What you do is simply ask yourself for earlier and earlier experiences. To ask yourself, what was I doing, not just yesterday, but last year? When that's clear, 5 years ago. When that's clear, 10 years ago. When that's clear, 20 years ago. 40 years ago. What was I doing when I was 2, when I was 1, when I was 6 months? Only when the mind is workable does this produce results. And the results which you get are not so much memories, more a reliving of experience. Just as in the process of hypnotic regression, the person was asked to go back to his earlier time, actually experiences the memory, rather than just thinking about it. As if you're right there, as if the smell is in your nose, as if the sight is in your ears. Even to the extent when I remember recalling one person remembering a previous existence when they were being whipped. Not only just feeling the pain, but even the welts appearing on their body. A strange thing, the power of mind over body. When one was experiencing these things, they actually manifested on their body. What I'm saying here is the recollection of past lives, which is achieved in this way, is achieved as an experience rather than as a thought. You're aware as that previous feeling. This is the way of proving that. Many monks have done this, many lay people have done this, and certainly the Buddha did this. And as one looks at the Buddha's life, this is what he did on the evening of his enlightenment. It was part of his enlightenment experience to use this very powerful mind, and he developed this mind through the power which is given through jhana meditation, which I've talked about here many, many times, attached to these deep absorptions. And having emerged from these absorptions, he recollected his past lives. He recollected his past lives as experiences of who he was, what his name was, who he was married to, what he did, what his job was, how long he lived, the country, the place, everything, in detail. Now you can imagine what it would be like if you recalled your past lives. The truth of reincarnation would be apparent to you, and no one would be able to convince you out of it. Moreover, even if it didn't fit your conceptual system, what you've been taught, what you want to believe, you'd have to accept it. Unfortunately, it's a difficult experiment for many. And so for many of us, perhaps we can use the standard of proof that there's other people who we respect who would not lie to us, who have no benefit derived from deceiving us, and they say these things with all the truth, with all sincerity. Why don't we accept it? What's blocking us? Why is it so hard to accept? What's sometimes hard to accept about reincarnation, the reason why other people dismiss it in spite of the evidence, in spite of reason, is that the consequences of reincarnation are sometimes unpalatable to people. Are unacceptable, because the consequences of reincarnation is that this is not your only life, you're going to have to go through this again, and again, and again, and again, and again, and again, until you get it right. For many people, they have had a hard life, a difficult life, and they don't want to do it again. That's one reason why they would deny the very existence of a future life. It's a denial made out of fear. A fear of the consequences of rebirth. The Buddha understood this and noticed this when he noticed that human life is, or rather has, a great proportion of difficulties and sufferings in it. But he also realized that just because you're suffering, you don't want to get reborn, tough luck, because it's not up to you. You can't just make that choice not to get reborn when you're having a hard time. It's just like I said, that people who are suicidal, who are so depressed and upset, their life is a failure, who they get so desperate, they take their own life. And what happens? They always fail. Suicide is always a failure, because after they die, they're still there. Now that's really depressing. They feel they can't do anything right. They're trying to get rid of themselves. Not understanding the truth of rebirth. Understanding the truth of rebirth has some very powerful consequences. If you know you have to live again, the main consequence is, well, if you're going to live again, how am I going to live again? In what state am I going to live again? And because of this consequence, the Buddha taught karma and its result. Karma is this law that whatever you do has its result. And it has its result either in this life or in the next life or some future life. That's a direct translation of the Buddha's word. That your deeds, the intentional acts of body, speech and mind, will always bear consequences in this life or the next life or in future life. And this law of karma is the only thing which will make people virtuous, kind, generous, looking after one another. Only if we see the results. Human beings, when it comes down to it, we only do something if there's something in it for us. If there's some happiness there for us. If there's some sense of even the happiness of achievement, even the happiness of seeing other people in harmony, seeing other people happy. And only if we see the effects and the truth of the law of karma will we really try and put our effort into doing that which is good, noble, generous, loving, compassionate. If we see it works. Now look at life. Look at the people you've known in life. The happy people in this life, the ones having a good time, are they always the good people? Are they always the kind people, the compassionate people, the generous people? Look. It's not always so, is it? There are a few really rotten, do-somethings. They're having a good time. And there are some very kind, generous, compassionate, wise, virtuous people who are suffering. Why? If we think of the law of karma and only do not accept rebirth, the whole thing falls down. It's either just chance, isn't it? Why are some people happy and some people not happy? Why are some people content, some people not content? You look at it, if it's just one life, it certainly can't be what you're doing. Because I see that some people are just doing terrible things and they're getting all the nasty words. They look like they're happy, and some people are just being really virtuous and kind and generous, and they're being abused, suffering, things are going wrong for them, they're getting ill, they're getting diseases. The kind people die. The bad ones keep on living and living and living. Sometimes that's how it seems. So if we look at just one life, the law of karma just does not fit with experience. It fails a scientific test. It may sound good, but it's not true. In one life. If we look at many lives, we can actually see the workings of the laws of karma. That an act of body, speech and mind which is done now may not give rise to its fruit in this life, the next life, or in the future life. And that becomes a very neat explanation of why some people are born in lions. Where from the very start of their life, they experience suffering and deprivation. So often, don't you ever think, whenever you see these documentaries about Rwanda or Ethiopia, there's some children, some babies even, born into this land. What have they done to deserve this? Don't you ever feel that sort of that compassion and that why feeling inside of you? When you understand karma, you can maybe get an explanation here. Why it is that some people are born in deprivation, because of something they've done in the past life. What that does is not sort of be able to dismiss this and say, well, it's just their karma, I shouldn't do anything. No, because one has to make one's own good karma now and go and help. If you don't help, maybe you'll have you there the next time. It gives a very good explanation of what we should be doing. That if we are selfish, if we are hurtful, if we only think of ourselves, maybe that's the future for us. Not as a sense of punishment, but a sense of natural causality. As someone once said, you're not punished for your deeds, you're punished by them. No punisher there. No sort of being somewhere that's sending you to this place or that place, but a gravitating here according to natural laws. Whether one likes it or not. So the law of time and rebirth makes it very worrying for people if they've been living a very heedless life. And that's why many people would deny the law of reincarnation out of fear of the consequences. But however, those people who understand the truth of this will use this teaching, the Jesus law, to say, well, look, maybe I accept rebirth, maybe I can prove it for myself, but at the very least, I cannot disprove it. I cannot be sure that reincarnation or rebirth doesn't exist. If it does exist, maybe I should make sure that my future is a prosperous and happy one. And how does one do that? By making good karma. And you all should know what good karma is. Acts of generosity, compassion, selflessness, doing acts of wisdom as well, being kind to the people around you, to the animals around you, to all of existence around you. At the very least, one should realize that if reincarnation is true, there's a good chance you'll be reborn right here in this world. And you'll have to live with the pollution, with the overpopulation, with any ecological disasters which you create now. You'll have to live with it, not your children. Not your children's children, but you will. Put it that way, it makes us a bit more careful, a bit more diligent to look after even our planet, if we know we're going to have to keep on living here. If you're living in a rented house, you're only going to be there for 1 year, you don't worry about it so much. But if you know you're going to be living in this house, not 1 year, not 30 years, but keep on coming back again and again and again and again, 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, you should really look after it and build it and look after it well. These are some of the consequences of reincarnation and the law of karma. So I'm saying, if one doesn't understand these, the law of karma and causation, then there is no logical imperative to really be moral and to do something about one's life. But more than that, the law of reincarnation starts to show you what we, in Buddhism we call samsara. And sometimes the suffering inherent in samsara, because no matter how much good we do, how much of a kindness we do, we always find that we do some things which are not so kind, selfish. And why? Because we know that each of us still has defilement, still has delusion inside of us. We still get angry, we still get selfish, we get greedy. Why? What is the cause of the bad karma which can create problems for us? And the reason is we look in our hearts, in our essence, especially in our meditation, we see there are things which we call basically craving or desire. It's blind craving because it's not in our interest, it's not to our benefit. In just the same way a person may be smoking, say, drugs, and know it's bad for them. They may be taking alcohol and know it's bad for their health. They may be eating fast food with lots of grease and oil, knowing they've got a heart condition. They can't stop. Why? Because of craving. Craving is unwise desire. It's a desire which searches for happiness, but because of its delusion, only finds suffering. We seek for comfort, we seek for satisfaction, but if it is craving, this desire which is not wise, which is not going to lead to our goal of happiness, but which is going to lead to its opposite, then this is the cause of suffering. And that craving inside of us is the cause of all the bad karma we do. Many religions and Buddhism tells you to do good and stop doing evil, to be kind, to love your enemies, to be compassionate, to do all these good things, to give donations to good causes, you know, to help the poor people in the world. Sometimes you may pass somebody who's crying, but you're late for work and you have to rush down. Maybe what you thought about it afterwards? I remember very clearly just going on an arms round in Bangkok once as a young monk, having my bowl full to the brim with food, and passing a beggar on the street, thinking to, I've got so much food, I can share something. But for one reason or another, out of embarrassment, I'm not really knowing whether this is a done thing, I found some excuse not to dip my hand in the bowl and to give this poor man something. I felt terrible about it afterwards. And I asked myself, why did I do that? And I realized that afterwards that my mind was not pure, it's still complaining, it's still out of control, it still did not see what was in its best interest and the interest of others. If you like, it was a stupid mind. A mind with defilement which could not see clearly. A mind which is obsessed either by greed or pride or whatever. I don't know that in my own life. So many religions and paths teach one to be good, but the great thing about this particular path, it teaches you how to do it. How to train the mind. How to uncover those defilements and eradicate them so they're not there anymore, so the mind is truly generous, it is truly compassionate, it is truly wise, so you can love your neighbors and your enemies as well, and yourself. It teaches you how, and the law of reincarnation gives you the incentive. When you know you can't get away with anything in this world, you can't get away with any unkind action, it's going to rebound on you sometime. You can't get away from any hurtful action, angry action. So when you really accept that, when you accept the first of all the law of the incarnation, the result is it gives us incredible fear of the consequences of bad deeds. And this is actually a noble quality which the Buddha described. He goes to this word in this Pali place of Sanskrit called Hiriyotika. The fear of the consequences of bad deeds. Just in the same way that many fears in life are good, they should not be abandoned. The same as you fear to put your hand in fire because you know it's going to hurt. You don't give up that fear. You go up that fear, you're always putting your hand in the fire. And hurting yourself or crashing hot things. It is a fear which knows the results of harmful action and which motivates the mind to resist, to say no. Without that fear of the results of bad deeds, one will not have the means to say no. It's again just going back to say that the smoker, it's only when the smoker really knows the results of his smoking, what it's actually doing to him, that he has the incentive, the motivation to give up and say no to a very deep-seated craving, a deep-seated habit in the mind. So understanding the result of one's food gives one this powerful incentive to do something about it. It gives one the powerful incentive to root out the defilements of the mind, to train oneself and not to waste time. Human being, a great time wasted. We think that we are immortal, in the sense we've got all the time in the world to do something which is good. The days and nights pass relentlessly by, the Buddha said. How well are we spending our time? The notice is the way this mind works, and how this process of reincarnation actually occurs. It occurs so often that people will argue against reincarnation by saying that how does the link occur? What is the process which goes from one life to another? And it's only when we develop deep meditation we can actually see this process. And in fact, the identification of the process of rebirth is part of the experience which occurs to the meditator when they achieve the first path and fruit. The first stage of enlightenment includes the understanding of the process of rebirth. And that process of rebirth, many of you may have come across it in your readings, it's a really profound part of Buddhism is called dependent origination. In Pali, Patika Samuppada. I'm mentioning this for those who've been here many times. It may sound like double dutch to you, come to the self price. But what it does say is that from craving, from this unwise desire for things which aren't in our best interest, we develop attachment. This attachment which grasps onto the object of our desires and clings to it in spite of reason, even though we know that these things are going to fade away from us, we are going to be separated from all that we love and desire eventually because of the law of impermanence and change. Nevertheless, the attacks we grasp, we won't let go. Because of that attachment, there comes into being new existence and rebirth. And look at the service, and he gave this explanation of how rebirth occurs. It is the causal connection. It is the energy going across from one life to the next. I call it energy, you could call it karma, going across. Indeed, the best simile I have heard for this is a simile of two billiard balls hitting one another. One is stationary, the other is sent hurtling towards the stationary billiard ball. As they strike, the one which was moving stops. And the one which was stopped starts moving. What went across from one billiard ball to another? It's the energy of motion, the energy of doing, the energy of craving, the energy of attachment. That's what went across. And we try to look, what was in the original billiard ball, which is now transferred into the second billiard ball? It's not energy, not a thing, but a quality. When one understands this, one understands the deep teaching of non-self and how we can have reincarnation without a soul going from one body to another. Or to use the Buddhist simile, when he described this, it's like having one candle lit on the altar. And that candle is burning down and burning down and burning down. And just before it burns out completely, you take a fresh candle and you hold its wick, the wick of the old candle. The old candle goes out, the new candle starts with its flame. What's gone across from one to the other? We look, there's nothing in the new candle which was in the old candle. So nothing could have gone across. Just energy, just the flow. We see here how rebirth occurs. Without a soul. If you don't understand this, you can look in your own life. What's going across from moment to moment now? What's gone across from moment to moment in all the years of your life? How old are you now? 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. What is here now in your body or in your mind that was there 30 years ago? 30 years ago. Science, the anatomy of the body, would say there's not a cell in your body which remains from when you were a baby. All the cells get replaced towards every 7 years or so. There's not a cell left of your body when you're a baby. What about your mind? The personality is always changing, the consciousness is always changing, it's always in flux. There's actually nothing there which was there when you were a baby. Sometimes it's too much so you talk like a baby, but you don't really. And the whole personality will completely change. And will continue to change. If you really look carefully at this human life, you can see the same process which goes on after death. And indeed, people experience this passage from one life to the next. The thing which they remark, which they recall, just how smooth that transition is. How the transition from one life to another is just like the transition now. So maybe sitting here and walking outside. It is the stream of consciousness, similar to the water flowing through the the rivers of our world, so take the river Swan, if you stand on the narrow bridge. You see the water flowing past today. You see the water flowing past tomorrow. It all looks the same, but we all know it's different water. You see the mind today and the mind tomorrow. It may look the same, but we all know, like the water, it's a different thing. It's a flowing of consciousness. And when we understand how this consciousness flows from one life to another, we understand the process of rebirth. We understand the process of rebirth. We understand its consequences. We have the imperative to do that which is good and to stop doing that which is harmful. We become good people, compassionate people, and wise people. These were teachings which were so common in the time of the Buddha, as they were also common in the early years of European civilization, from Plato to Pythagoras to the early church fathers in the Christian church. They too accepted reincarnation as an obvious truth. For Voltaire, who once said that it's no more amazing that you were born many times than you were born once. Both are equally amazing. To people of the present day. So this is a talk this evening, I should maybe stop now, it's an answer, about the Buddhist idea of rebirth and reincarnation. To sum up, it is a very vital teaching of Buddhism, because its consequences are very deep-reaching, and without that acceptance of reincarnation, one will find it very difficult, if not impossible, to truly be moral. One will not have the incentive to do so. If one can get away with something in this lifetime, one will. But seeing the consequences as far-reaching, reaching not just this life, but many other lives, gives us enormous incentive. And that's why the Buddha said it is part of right view. And it will give one the encouragement to really find out the causes of that which we call unhelpful or unskillful karma. The causes of unhappiness in this and future lives. And without incentive, we'll eradicate those causes. And we'll become someone who does never create bad karma ever again. And we can see this thing in our own lives for ourselves by not demanding absolute proof, but demanding a standard of proof which we'll give to other things in our life. And if we really want to, and we really demand proof for ourselves, there is a way of recalling your own past life. So that's what I wish to say now about reincarnation. Are there any questions or comments you'd like to ask? Are there any questions? Yes, in the back there. Yes. You're asking the question that, having mentioned in my description of karma and its result of the country of Rwanda, that do I believe or do I accept what we call collective karma? In other words, the doings of a nation. In a sense, yes, because the doings of a nation are just the doings of individuals. A nation is just made up of its parts. And it's all of those individuals who actually carry the machetes, the ones who make the karma, not the country as a whole. I'm reminded of the story of the massacre of My Lai, I think, if I pronounced that right, in the Vietnam War, where a troop of American soldiers went into a village, shooting indiscriminately the men, women and children, taking no prisoners. There were some of the soldiers obeyed the orders and went in shooting. And there were some of the soldiers who, even though it meant the threat of court-martial, said no. There was something inside of them, even though they'd been trained as soldiers, even though they were in a theater of war. But something inside of them said, no, this is wrong, and they refused. So in collective karma, we all see those members of that group who refuse. You do have the choice to refuse. And you do have the opportunity. But you have to be encouraged, because sometimes the consequences might be threatening and fearful. But those who understand the law of reincarnation or rebirth know that the immediate consequences, say of court martial or whatever, are nowhere near as fearful as the greater consequences of a bad deed. You realize it's wrong, and you'd rather face displeasure or the anger of your commanding officer, say, than live with the memory of having done a very bad deed. You have the courage to resist. So that all those people who did wield the machete each create karma, and that sense is collective. But individuals always have the opportunity to refuse. So in that case, there's no such thing as collective karma. Okay, you're saying about a whole group suffering, about collective karma. Each of the people in that group would have probably had to have done some sort of action or deed which gave rise to them being in that group. Just saying, when I was in school as a child, each of the children in detention with me, each committed their own little crime. I did go to detention a few times. But I must admit that the fact of detention, if it was a really a good teacher, it wouldn't be a punishment. It would be a learning experience. And I've mentioned this before, that karma and its result, or the result of bad karma, should never be looked upon as a punishment. I've done something wrong, therefore I have to suffer. Rather, a learning experience. I've done something wrong, therefore I've been stupid. Now, I need sort of a lesson to teach me what's right. For example, just the way the Buddha taught, that so someone has been miserly. That, you know, you've had the resources, you know, you've had a bit of wealth. No one admits they've got wealth. You ask anyone in this land of Australia, they're all poor. But you don't help. You don't send donations, say, for a wonder or something. Now, what do you think the best way to teach a person a lesson is? Send them over to Rwanda. Not as a volunteer relief worker, because they also live in the hotels and get, you know, three main meals a day. But send a person to Rwanda as a young boy or girl who's lost their parents and all their other relatives, who have got nothing to eat for day after day after day. You go for that for a lifetime and you soon learn. You learn about generosity. You learn about sharing. You learn about the result of things like wars and the stupid causes which differentiate one group from another just because of tribe. Same with human beings. It's nice to be colorblind and genderblind and age-blind and religion-blind, and just as everyone, just human beings. I can see the difference. If you can't see the difference, how can you kill one person or be angry at one person? So karma and its results is a teaching opportunity. Some people take that lesson and learn very quickly. Some people go into detention once and they learn. Some kids go into detention week after week after week after week. The Buddha taught there's different types of forces. This is the teaching of the Buddha. It's a very nice teaching. He said, but one type of force, the owner or the rider, the trainer, only has to touch the whip. And it knows what to do straight away. With other types of forces, the owner has to raise the whip so the shadow falls on it. Then it realizes it should sort of change its ways and get it back together quick. Another type of force has to be just touched very lightly. with the whip, and then it knows what to do. The other horses are more stupid. They have to be hit by the whip just once, and then they know. Now some horses are so stupid, they have to be hit and hit and hit, and still they don't know. They don't learn. Then please don't be one of those last horses. If you do get into bad results of bad karma, learn very quickly. It's not pleasant to be born in Rwanda. It's not pleasant to be born as a poor person or a person who is deprived of their health or their faculties. So be kind and generous to people. Otherwise, one day you'll have to learn what it feels like to be someone with, say, AIDS. You know what it feels like with someone with MS, multiple sclerosis. Put yourself in their position before you have to really be in their position by being reincarnated there. Feel what they feel, then you'll know wise compassion. So, is that okay with collective karma? Is there another question someone would like to ask? I thought I'd get a few questions with reincarnation. That was a good one. How about this, first of all, yeah? Oh, I think it's really quick to know your past life. I know. Not me. Not the Buddha. No, not the Buddha didn't say that. He said it was quite useful. Because imagine if you could sit down, you remember your past lives. Number one, you would never doubt anymore about reincarnation. Number two, you would understand karma. And that would give you an enormous incentive, you know, to get a good rebirth next time with any rebirth. So it has enormous benefits to know your... And it also just proves an important aspect of Buddhism. And go for it. Find out. Because it gives you that sort of confirmation. Do an experiment. And you find out for yourself. It's the point, the way of Buddhism, the scientific method. Quick one from Roland. So I'll take that from the 1-7 meters. It's actually something else I've just seen the question before, yes. And there are some realms of existence where one doesn't make karma. One is just using up or experiencing results of past karma. In other words, that in these some realms, one hasn't really the freedom to really learn or understand, but just to sort of endure for a while. And but there are some heavenly realms, deva realms where one goes to, and other realms where one goes to, where one is so limited in what one can do. And that's why in the Buddhist description of the different realms, the human realm has the greatest degree of freedom to do both good karma and bad karma. The greatest degree of and flexibility of choice. And that's why they say the human realm is that realm in which it is most easy to gain enlightenment experience. Because one has a pretty even amount of happiness and suffering, one has both, and one is encouraged by the happiness, one is taught by the suffering. Whereas in other realms, it's sometimes just all suffering or just all happiness. So in like the realm of an amoeba, say, in such a realm, the greatest thing one can do, one gets stuck in these states. And it's everything one can do about it for a long while. Until eventually that the small little things can happen. Even in the realm of, say, like the animal, they have nowhere near freedom, much freedom as a human being. You imagine that the animals in the jungle, whose main concern is survival. and has not the freedom to really do much reflection or understanding, in much the same way that if you were always working, day in, day out, in the night, having no freedom to really think about life, if all of your energy is just in survival, you will have no real appreciation for any of the philosophies or religions in life. In that respect, the philosophies and religions are well described as a luxury for many people. But the law of karma just does work eventually, because if those potentials are stored up for a while, and when the karma works out, then one gets another chance, say a human life or another life, in order to learn. Because this is like the holidays in school. In holidays in school, you don't really have so much chance to learn. The teachers are away. But eventually those holidays are over, and you have a chance to go back to school and learn again. So you can look at these types of existences. Because when there's not so much chance to do things, there's not so much opportunity for pain. Because most of pain is frustrated choice, frustrated desire. So it's not such an unpleasant experience. It's more than just a very dull experience. Like a sleep. A long sleep between days. So that's the first question. The second question about the children who wander, who again are very young and die. Again, in those states, that they do not sort of experience the same type of mental suffering as a grown-up person experiences. Again, remember in Buddhism there's two types of suffering, the physical and the mental. The Buddha said two arrows pierce the human being. Physical pain and the mental pain. And the mental pain is by far the grossest and most hardest to bear. You may be in physical pain, but if the mind is at peace, the physical is nothing, no problem at all. But when there's a mental pain there, just as a person who's got a healthy body and has a good lifestyle, who has this mental pain of despair and depression, no matter how healthy or wealthy they are suffering enormously. And it's the truth that there's more suffering to be seen in the rich capitals of the world than there are in Rwanda or the poor places. Physical suffering is one thing. And we think it's the only one because it's the most apparent to us, because we cannot see into the minds of others. If you could see into the minds of others, you see and understand that mental suffering is by far the largest component, the most worrying of pain in the human being. The children, there's very little mental pain. As you get older, it increases. Your capacity for mental suffering increases. Kids don't think about it so much. You see a kid like in having an argument with one another. Sometimes it's like an argument to the death, you think. The next moment, they're sort of playing as if they were playing forever. They don't carry around mental suffering like grown-ups do. So maybe that might be an answer to that question. Anyway, if you have another question, I'm afraid you have to wait for your next life to answer it. Because now we should end now, we've gone over time. Has anyone got any announcements today to be made? I do. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam, and good evening, everybody. I think we're very lucky and probably had some very good karma somewhere in our lives, the past lives to have been born, or at least have the opportunity of living in peace and hearing the terrific Dharma talks we get here. A couple of short announcements from Martin. That's about the advanced Dharma class, which Ajahn started a month ago. It's on again this Sunday between 3 and 4 p.m. Sunday between 3 and 4 p.m. Classes are designed for people who have been studying the Dharma for a couple of years. And the last one we had was really wonderful. And I recommend for those of you who fit into that category that you might like coming on. Also, today we start a second round of 4 weeks of introduction to meditation classes, and they're designed to be at 2:30, between 2:30 and 3, for people who are new to meditation. And then at the end of that class, at 3 o'clock, those people will be joining other meditators in here at 3 o'clock for a meditation with Ajahn and other people. And we're very lucky that those classes for this month will be taken by Ron Story, who's a long-time meditator, and I think somebody who can also learn from. You might like to pass that information on to other people as well. We have an opportunity for you to earn some good karma, and that we are very much looking for, very urgently actually, looking for some people to help in the library. And if you think that you could reliably give some time, either on every second Friday night or have an urgent need for somebody on every second Saturday afternoon, we very much appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to see either myself or one of the people working in the library tonight, we will be very grateful indeed. It's a terrific opportunity to be able to put something back into the centre, as they appreciate that it takes a great number of people to keep this place running as reasonably smoothly as it usually does. The final thing is just an early announcement about New Year. And in this instance, I'm not talking about the 1st of January. I'm talking about Chinese New Year. And for those of you who have been coming here for a lot of years and have experienced this terrific fundraising and fun event, will know that it's something that we all look forward to. There's a notice on the notice, but I can't actually remember the date. It was an early announcement. I think it's the end of January. A notice on the notice for tonight. And I'd like to have a look at that and read it according to your brand new 1995 diary. I hope that you'll enjoy a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, or a cup of mala, or a glass of water, or just simply chat over in the house after this. And perhaps you'll join us at that time. Thank you.
Thank you, Jewel Perry. Best of all, Dhamma Swan. If you do have any questions, if I'm feeling guilty now, please come up and ask afterwards.
Bhagavata Sāvaka Sāṅkha